Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a podcast about the rulers of the ancient Roman Empire. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, a senior lecturer in classics and ancient history at La Trobe University. This is episode LXXX, Dio Cassius. For much of our journey through the Antonine Dynasty, we've had Dio Cassius as our guide. As both a historian and a senator, Dio had a ringside seat to some of the greatest emperors the Roman Empire has seen. He wrote an extensive and what is considered reliable history of the Roman Empire, spanning 80 volumes, many of which we have today. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
Dio Cassius is a Roman historian, although he wrote in Greek, and he wrote a massive history of 80 books that takes us right from the beginning of Rome through the imperial period to the end of the Severan dynasty.
We've got confusion with his name. So I've seen it written down as both Dio Cassius and Cassius Dio. So which one are we using and why?
Well, I use Dio Cassius. I think, although I'm not 100% clear whether this is a firm distinction, it seems to me that North American scholars tend to use Cassius Dio. They are more correct, because his name was probably Lucius Cassius Dio. The Cassius bit is Roman, as you might guess. The Dio bit is definitely Greek. So this shows us that his name makes him a hybrid of Roman and Greek.
Yeah.
He's culturally Greek, but he's very, very Roman in terms of his citizenship. He's a very high-born Roman. He's got the three names of a Roman if his name was Lucius Cassius Dio.
Yeah.
We think it was that because there is a military diploma that's been found that lists a Lucius Cassius Dio that looks like the right time, and it could well be him. Occasionally, he is also given the extra name Coceianus, but this is almost certainly wrong. It was a name given to Dio Chrysostom, who's another writer earlier, who might well be the grandfather of our Dio. His name, by the way, means golden mouth in Greek.
That's good.
Great.
Yes. Yeah. He was a philosopher, though, wasn't he?
A speaker, an orator, rhetorician, hence golden mouth.
Sure.
So if you go Cassius Dio, you're going Roman and then Greek name. If you say Dio Cassius, as I do, then you're saying Greek and then Roman name. And by the way, we say Dio, but it would have been pronounced Dio.
Generally, when we talk about a historian in these podcasts, we know very little about them because they've written some great books, but they haven't written an autobiography. This seems to be a little bit different with Dio because there's a lot of him in his text, especially when we get to the contemporary time, you know, when he was alive during the reign of Commodus onwards, say. So is that our best source for the life of Dio Cassius?
It's basically our only source because he doesn't write an autobiography, as you said, and other people don't write about him, or at least we don't have those writings if they did. So it's what we can get out of his text.
But there's a lot more of him in his text than other historians put of themselves in their own texts. Does
that
make sense? Tacitus didn't put any of himself in his text. Suetonius didn't really either.
Tacitus has a little bit. It tends, as it is with Dio, to be when they can remember. Suetonius says, I can remember as a boy standing around and hearing this speech. Tacitus lived through the reign of Domitian and makes this clear to us in the Agricola. But with Tacitus, we do also have some external evidence, like a letter that the younger Pliny writes to him. We don't have that with Dio, but he does talk about himself a lot more because he lived through a lot of the later history he writes about. And he's really quite open with his thoughts on that and his experience of it and his reaction to it. Mm. So we're not just inferring it. He tells us directly, I really didn't like Commodus.
Yes.
And that kind of thing. There's a lot more written, in fact, on the change from Republic to Empire, so on the late Republic and on Augustus. And he puts in a lot of opinion there about what he thinks of that important political, you know, constitutional change. And he continues to give us what we would regard as opinion. And this is one of the reasons why scholars of ancient history would sort of put him a degree lower than people like Tacitus.
Yeah.
Although, goodness knows, we're not getting an impartial view with Tacitus. But I guess for a modern parallel, they would see Dio as a bit more like the tabloid press, more opinion than verified fact. But Dio is really important for us, so we shouldn't perhaps be as scathing as some people are.
So what do we know about his life, say his early life, maybe the stuff that doesn't reach his history books?
Well, we know that he was born in the Greek East, in modern Turkey, in a place called Bithynia, in a town called Nicaea, perhaps around 155 CE, so middle of the second century, yeah. Anyway. Could be slightly later. These dates are worked out based on the date at which he came into the Senate and the date at which he got particular magistracies.
So there's a general age that you would get those positions at, so count there's back
meant,
from that.
There's meant to be a minimum age.
Yeah.
Sometimes those rules are broken. His father, we know, was called Cassius Apronianus, who himself had been a significant political figure. So he's a senator and he had been consul in the second century. And he'd also had proconsulships, in other words, governorships of different provinces.
Mm.
So he's born into a family that's already has had a lot of political involvement. So not surprising that he has that life too. And he has a very successful political career. So as I say, even though his last name is Greek and he writes in Greek and is culturally Greek, by this period, that doesn't mean that you're divorced from the center of Roman politics at all. He's at the center of Roman politics. He was consul twice. He was a proconsul or governor of eastern provinces of Pergamum and then Smyrna. The first time he was consul, he was what we call suffect consul in 205 CE. And that means the person who was consul had died, probably. Wasn't being consul anymore, so he's the kind of the substitute for that year. The second time he's consul, though, he is the what we call the ordinary consul in 229. So he gets that role officially. Every time you get to be consul by this period, it's something that the emperor has sanctioned. And indeed, in 229, he was consul along with the current emperor, Alexander Severus. He was also proconsul in Africa, Dalmatia, and Upper Pannonia. And in Upper Pannonia, he would have had some military experience, direct contact with the military, because we're told there was very poor discipline there. So he had to deal with that prospect. It wasn't the kind of proconsulship where you just went in and served out your year or so enjoying yourself.
Yeah.
He had work to do. He's primarily then a politician, but he has also got this kind of on-the-ground experience in all these different provinces. So it's a very active life that he has in the Roman political system.
So he has a very long and successful career as a senator, as a leader in Rome. But we know him more so as the author of an extensive history work, which is 80-odd books. So would the Romans know him as a senator and a leader or as a historian? And maybe what would he consider himself to be?
Well, that's a good question. It's not uncommon for a Roman leader to do both things from much earlier periods.
Yeah.
And we should remember that Tacitus was also working his way through the Roman political system. Combining those two roles is not uncommon, but I guess Dio Cassius perhaps has a longer lasting political career than most of them. He does live into a grand old age, probably till about 80, which is very old for a Roman. And he retires back to Bithynia in old age.
Back to his home.
Yeah, his work shows us that he's always carried this affection for Bithynia. He calls it home in his work. He calls Rome the center of power or something like that, but he doesn't refer to it as his home, even though he spends most of his life there. So it's hard to know whether Dio's work at the time he was writing it is defining him. So it's hard to know how influential it was, because it doesn't seem particularly influential after his life. Mm. So I reckon the Romans would have known him most prominently as a consul and proconsul.
Okay, so let's talk about the work that he left us with. Does it actually have a name?
It's usually called The Roman History. It's a very big, broad name. So this is a work that's 80 books long, but it started out much more humbly, and Dio actually tells us how he got started in book 73, the time which is during his life. He says, "I had written and published a little book about the dreams and portents which gave Severus reason to hope for the imperial power." So it's actually not a history book, really. It's one that concerns a particular episode.
Yeah.
So Severus, who's going to inaugurate the new dynasty in the 3rd century, and it's on a particular theme, which is something that Dio keeps going back to, portents.
So he wrote some Severus fan fiction.
Kind of, yeah, I guess so. And it's a good move because, of course, it brings him particularly to the attention of Severus, although he's already a prominent politician. And Dio goes on, he, after reading the copy I sent him, good move.
Yeah.
Wrote me a long and complimentary acknowledgement. This letter I received about nightfall and soon after fell asleep. And in my dreams, the divine power commanded me to write history. God told me to do it. That's what Dio actually says.
Wow. Divine power is an interesting phrase to put in this context. So what was Dio talking about then? What does the Greek tell us?
He uses the term tot, means the, and daimonion. Daimonion is the word that gives us demon, but that's very misleading.
So the demon told me to write.
Etymology. Yeah, that would be bad.
The voices in my head told me.
It means a supernatural power.
Yeah, okay.
Of some kind. It's quite vague and can be taken all kinds of ways, but it's not as malevolent as demon is for us. I'm interested that the verb translates as divine power with capital D, capital P.
Mm.
I don't think that's actually very reflective of what daimonion means. It means something outside of our understanding, something that's more than human, but it doesn't refer to a specific god. It doesn't even use the word theos, meaning god. So it's appropriately vague. You know, it could even be the equivalent of when poets talk about the muse. The muse is a goddess who helps them write poetry. So maybe this is the historian's equivalent of the muse.
Nice. Wasn't there a specific muse of histories?
There is. There's Clio.
Yeah.
Clio, the muse of history. So yeah, you're right. He could have said Clio. It kind of gives more authority to his writing, I suppose. There's some kind of divine order that this should happen.
Mm.
It's even more of a compliment to Severus, of course, that there's some divinity that wants this to be. Because when you're writing a history that goes up to your own day, the implication is that everything that's happened before, and in Dio's case, it is everything, because he started right at the beginning, it's all leading up to now. This is the end point of all of that history. So it is quite a complimentary thing to do to the current leader.
So he starts off by writing about the omens and portents of Severus, but then he continues.
He does. And he says, so that's how I came to write this. I then conceived a desire to compile a record of everything else that concerned the Romans. I decided not to just write this first treatise, he calls it, but to incorporate it in this present history. Mm. So he's going to take what he started out with, which was much more contemporary, and make it part of this long history, a single work, as he calls it, that would be a record of everything from the beginning down to the point that shall seem best to fortune.
So while we don't have his first work, his treatise on portents and omens of Septimius Severus, where he talks about that in the text, will likely incorporate what he'd written earlier.
Yes. That's why he talks about it there and not right at the beginning, because this is where he's going to retool that earlier work and put it in here. This idea, though, of writing everything from the beginning to your own point is what something that Livy had already done during the Augustan period in Latin, which is trying, you know, he started off with mythological Rome, with Aeneas coming to Rome and then Romulus building Rome, right from the mythology through the kings down to the start of the Republic, and in many, many, many books,
yeah,
you know, well over 100 books. So there's a precedent for this. And because he's writing so much later, 200 years later than Livy, he's going to include a lot more history.
Mm.
The history of the emperors has now been added to all of that.
This is quite a lot of Dio in this for a history book.
It is. Yeah, he's telling us about his methodology, how he came to write it, where it comes from. We don't often get that. He also tells us how long it took. It's easy to forget how long it takes to write these works. Not that I've got any kind of axe to grind here. He says he spent 10 years doing the research, 10 years collecting all the achievements of the Romans from the beginning down to the death of Severus, and then 12 more years writing it, 12 years composing my work. So it took 22 years.
But then he continues the work on, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. And he says, as for subsequent events, they shall also be recorded down to whatever point shall be permitted to me. So it's ongoing. The length of time it took him to write it, as he states, it probably means he started right at the beginning of the 3rd century, around 202 CE. He didn't actually go as far as possible down to his death. That was almost certainly because he moved off into relative obscurity, away from Rome, back to Bithynia.
That's called retiring.
Yeah, well.
You won't call it relative obscurity when you retire.
It will be obscurity, I'm sure. The fact is that he doesn't have access to the materials anymore, so it's harder for him to write in something in so much detail about Severus Alexander, for example.
At that point, I suppose, it becomes not history, but political commentary, if you want to, for the last seven books of the histories.
That's a whole, I think we could probably have a tutorial on that. It's not clear in Dio that he makes that separation, is it? Which is interesting, because I think we do. I think you're quite right. If it's happening to him, it is, as you say, political commentary. It's news, really. It's analysis of contemporary events. But for Dio, it's still in his Roman history.
Let's talk about the text itself then. We know that he had a dream that told him to write this book, but how did he justify writing it to his audience? What does he start off with?
Yeah, he does give us the agenda, which is something a lot of historians do, and it's nice that we've got that. He says, "It is my desire to write a history of all the memorable achievements of the Romans," and not surprising it takes 80 books, "as well in time of peace as in war, so that no one, whether Roman or non-Roman, shall look in vain for any of the essential facts." He really wants to be encyclopedic. It's all going to be here. The reason he says in time of peace as well as in war is because, of course, we do have histories that are war commentaries, like Caesar's Gallic and Civil Wars, if you want to call those histories. But certainly, I suppose the greatest example is Thucydides of the Peloponnesian War.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to do that. And he's not even going to talk about all the wars. We actually have a writer called Florus who just goes through all the Roman wars in very brief form.
Have you not heard of him?
Two short books that just go from war to war to war. He is doing quite the opposite. He also wants us to talk about Rome's civic history.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a lot of years to cover. 1,400 years is a big span. Obviously, it's going to start off with mythology, though, because the Romans don't have records going back that far.
Yeah.
It is tradition that Roman history starts with Aeneas after he leaves the Trojan War, which people date it differently, but it's usually around 1200 BCE. So you get Aeneas coming to Italy, founding the Roman race, and going all the way down to Dio's retirement in 229 CE, which is the end of the Severan dynasty.
So let's talk about how the text, which covers a long amount of history, how does Dio divide that kind of content up?
Well, it's divided up into books, obviously, the 80 books, and various scholars talk about divisions which reflect Rome's history. So, for example, the translator of the Lurb, Ernest Carey, talks about the division into three distinct sections. And he says this is based upon what Dio says within the text. So the first is, and this makes sense, is the Republic. Just to be clear, of course, we did have monarchy before that, and the Republic starts traditionally in 509 BCE. But we'll just talk about that as being the Republic, and the first period ending with the Republic, and the transition to empire, which is something that really interests Dio, and he talks about at great length. And this occurs in book 53 of Dio. The section Carey is pointing to, it's in the middle of a book, so I don't know if everyone would be easily persuaded that this is a strong division point. But Carey says book 53, chapter 19, is a point of separation. In any case, Dio has a really interesting statement about the change of government, the change from the Republican constitution, where you basically have an oligarchy, to one-man rule that we get under Augustus. And his attitude towards it is that, and I'll read it out, 53:19, "In this way, the government was changed at that time for the better and in the interest of greater security, for it was no doubt quite impossible for the people to be saved under a republic. Nevertheless, the events occurring after this time cannot be recorded in the same manner as those of previous times." So I think this is why Carey says there's a division here, because he's saying, as a historian, I have to admit that there's a change, and the change is actually all about transparency.
Yeah.
It's quite topical for us, I think. He goes on, "Formerly, as we know, all matters were reported to the Senate and to the people, even if they happened at a distance. Hence, all learned of them and many recorded them, and consequently the truth regarding them, no matter to what extent fear or favour, friendship or enmity, coloured the reports of certain writers, was always to a certain extent to be found in the works of the other writers who wrote of the same events and in the public records." So he has an interesting idea that in the Republic there was a lot more transparency. But after this time, most things that happened began to be kept secret and concealed. Even though some things are perchance made public, they are distrusted just because they cannot be verified. So he's saying that the emperors covered things up, and they were able to do that because not everybody had access to.
But at the same time, he sounds like he's a fan.
He's basically mirroring that view that there was such chaos towards the end of the Republic and violence that we had to have something else. We had to have a strong man, basically, and Augustus gave us that. But it means as an historian, you don't know whether what you're getting is verifiable or not.
Okay. So I can see why Carey said, right, that's the division. That's the point where he's going to have to change how he's recording the history.
Very much so. It's not just a change in the Roman constitution. It's also a change in how the facts come down to you.
Yeah.
So the second period is during the imperial period when, as we've seen, Dio doesn't trust the evidence he has quite so much. And then the third period is that of his own lifetime, where he doesn't have to rely on other people's evidence, other people's reports.
Mm.
Well, he can at least add to other people's reports his own experience.
Yeah.
He has that firsthand knowledge. And he's got a lot more detail and even more opinion. He has a lot of opinions about the time that he is alive. So this division into three, I think, is viable. It sort of, to a certain extent, follows an important change in Rome's own history from Republic to Empire, and then a change in terms of Dio's experience of it because he's there.
Yeah.
On the spot.
All right. So what style is Dio writing his histories in then?
Well, in terms of the whole format, it is quite like Livy and very typical of Roman historians. So he's writing in a Roman tradition, even though he writes in Greek, because he's going year by year in what we call the annalistic form.
Mm.
It might seem an obvious way to write history. It's very much bound up with Roman ways of thinking because, of course, they have consuls that rule for a year and they actually name their year by the consuls. And they have public records that are about what happens in each year. This is a form of history that concentrates on what happens in one particular year, as opposed to, let's talk about this war. You know, the war might last 10 years.
Yeah.
And then we'll go back 10 years to talk about what was happening at home.
Mm.
They don't do it like that. They'll talk about what happened in the war that year and what happened at home that year, and then move on to the next year. Dio often names the consuls, so he's clearly following this tradition. It's something Tacitus did as well. And Dio will do it down to the precise day that an emperor becomes emperor and dies. So really, it's a very Roman form of history, one that they have long done, even though he's writing in Greek. He is a senator, and so he has to come from a senatorial point of view, although he doesn't seem as bitter about the death of the Republic as someone like Tacitus does. So he's writing history not as someone who thinks this monarchy should never have happened, which is the impression Tacitus sometimes gives us. Because as we've already seen, he saw it as inevitable that Augustus had to come along and take control, even though it changed the way he could write history. Because he's Greek, Dio is very aware, though, of his Greek forebears in the historical tradition. And the Romans have been very influenced by this too. And the way he writes Greek is clearly modelled on the Greek of Thucydides. So Thucydides, a classical Greek writer, many, many centuries before writing the Peloponnesian War back in the 4th century BCE. So he's deliberately harking back to classical Athens by writing in Attic Greek.
But that would have been the gold standard anyway, so it's a good...
Absolutely. But it's this kind of combination of Roman forms of writing history, the style he writes it in, so the sentence structures and the kinds of vocabulary harking back to Thucydides.
So what sources was Dio using then? As a senator, we've already said that he probably had access to records, but he's also got access to the other historians that have come before him and their collective works.
Yes, and indeed historians whom we don't have anymore. It's kind of easier to say whom he didn't use, because if we've got that source and Dio seems to do something completely different, then he probably didn't use him. He doesn't tell us very often who he's using, so that makes it harder. Some historians do.
Mm.
He would have known Livy, and obviously he's using the same format as Livy. He doesn't seem to have used Sallust, who is an important late Republican source, who one of his works is the Catalinian Conspiracy, they don't seem to figure. And nor Caesar's accounts of his own wars in any detail, which is quite surprising.
Mm.
But he is using Tacitus, who almost immediately was the Roman historian of the imperial period and the source you had to go use, the go-to man for the reign of Tiberius right up to the end of Domitian's reign. And that's useful to us because people who've been listening for a while will know that we don't have all of Tacitus. And there are times when we have Dio, say, for the reign of Domitian. Don't have any of Tacitus. What we know about Tacitus's attitude comes from his biography of his father-in-law, Agricola. But he did write about the reign of Domitian. It's gone from the histories. But we do have Dio, who was able to read that portion of Tacitus. So that's really important for us.
Yay, Dio.
Yeah, exactly. I think people have underestimated Dio. I'm grateful to him. And he does, he likes to read people's biographies and autobiographies. I think he liked a bit of gossip, and there's nothing wrong with that. Memoirs of people like Augustus. Augustus wrote his memoirs, as did Hadrian, and Dio seems to know about them, also the Emperor Severus. And he does actually refer to those. So those are instances where he tells us.
That I got this from that text.
Exactly.
And that's how we can know and lament the fact that we don't have the autobiography of Hadrian.
Yeah.
Although, did you recently hear that they found some more tablets at
Vindolanda?
I'm sure that there is the autobiography of Hadrian in there.
They're letters mostly, and which are really interesting for daily life.
Don't take this away from me.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure we're going to find Hadrian's autobiography there. You never know, though. Maybe it was light reading for some of the people who had to hang out near the wall. His wall.
We, unfortunately, but not surprisingly, do not have an intact 80 books worth of Roman history from Dio. So what do we have and how complete is the work?
Okay. We've lost about 2/3 of it in its original form. Sounds bad, but then it's a very long work and we do have things to supplement, so it's okay. The bit that we have particularly is books 37 to 60. And that is the period of the late Republic from the 60s BCE through the Aurelian period to sometime in the reign of Claudius, the 40s CE. So that 100 years or so, we've got the original Dio. There are a few gaps, especially after 6 BCE, so it's not all completely there. The first 36 books, we've got fragments remaining. But where we've got missing, and we've said we've got Dio through all of that imperial period, we've been using him as an historian. There are obviously versions of Dio existing for post-Claudius. We've got epitomes.
Mm.
In other words, summaries. And there are two main epitomizers. Both have great names. One of them is called Xiphilinus, which starts with an X. And the other one, Zonarus. And they were both monks from the 11th and 12th centuries. Xiphilinus is an 11th century monk. Zonarus was a Byzantine historian who went off to be a monk as well. He covers the early Roman period. Xiphilinus fills in more of the imperial period. So between them, we've got epitomes, we've got summaries of what Dio wrote throughout the whole of the imperial period.
When we say summaries, they're quite extensive summaries, aren't they?
They are. Summaries sounds like dot points, and it's not that at all.
Yeah.
It's absolutely complete sentences and books of varying lengths, but books that are long enough to be proper books.
Mm.
For example, book 73, which we've used a lot when we look at, say, the Emperor Commodus. In the lurb that I have in front of me here, the epitome of book 73 goes from page 72 to page 121. Now, that is Greek and Latin, so it's parallel text. So that's, what, about 50 pages, 25 pages if you're taking only the Greek.
Yeah. They're extensive works, so they must have been quite mammoth texts. I can see why it took Dio so long to write.
Yeah, exactly. It would have been... The lurb that I have here, which is not the last one, obviously, is volume 9.
Yep.
If we had the whole thing, how many volumes would we have? I'll have to sit down and calculate it. 30 or more lurbs?
Yeah. So, yeah. So if we were not missing the 2/3 that we have and we were replacing the existing epitomes,
probably more than 30.
Yeah.
Now I come to think of it. So it's a bit of a shame. Strangely, considering that Dio's his whole vision is that you'll never have to consult another book, almost. Mm. You will know all the facts if you read him. He does seem to leave out some really important events occasionally. Now, later on, you could put this down to the epitomizers. Maybe they're leaving them out. But in those books that we have Dio, particularly the ones that cover the transition from Republic to Empire, occasionally he'll leave out an important historical event, like, for example, what we call the conference at Lucca, which was in 56 BCE. Broadly speaking, when Julius Caesar and Pompey and Crassus got together to renew their agreement that we call the First Triumvirate, which was how they were going to rule Rome,
yeah,
without telling anyone. This conference is really important in terms of constitutional change. It was not in Dio, even though we've got original Dio for those books.
So he said he wanted to be a completist in times of war and peace. And he's left that out. Has he said anything about it at all? Or?
No, it's not there. And if you want to be anti-Dio, this can be one of your missiles to say, well, the conference at Lucca isn't there. So it's true that sometimes maybe his sources were inadequate or he didn't trust them. Although he says he trusts Republican sources better than later ones, but maybe he's getting it from a later source that he feels has misrepresented it. We just don't know. It is very, very strange because it features so significantly in all other accounts we have of that particular period. And certainly in retrospect, that's an important link in the chain of the Republic breaking down because there's three men ruling it on their own.
So that's a point against him, but in his defense, why is it an important text? Why is this great to have?
It fills in so many blanks for us. So all of those periods where we're missing Livy and we're missing Tacitus, Dio will still be there, at least in epitome form. That's really important, not just because it gives us some version of the facts, but it also gives us an early third century version of them. So it's quite interesting to look at Dio in his own right and think about how a Greek man who's very much politically Roman in that period looked back at the transition to Augustus. You know, in the past, I think people have used Dio just to fill in those gaps, but he's actually quite interesting in his own right as a third century author. And he fills in one very important gap where we've got no imperial biographies, of course. So remember, Suetonius goes up to Domitian, who dies in 96 CE. And then we've got briefly Nerva for a couple of years and Trajan. And the Historia Augusta takes up the biographies again with Hadrian. So we've got nothing for those two. And I don't know if people remember at the time, I'm pretty sure we mentioned that if you have the Penguin Lives of the Later Caesars, Burley reconstructs a life of Nerva and a life of Trajan.
He does.
And he's basically doing that from Dio. So he's filling it in as if it's a biography, but his main source is Dio. So he's really significant for that period because we've got nothing else going on. I mean, we've got things like Pliny's letters, but in terms of somebody sitting down and recording history, Dio is it. Other events, say the rebellion of Boudicca in Britain, are in other texts. Tacitus talks about it in the Annals, and it also comes up in the Agricola. But Dio's is the most extensive account, and he also really expands upon it. And I don't know whether he's getting this from somewhere or if he's written it himself. He gives Boudicca this amazing speech where she rouses up the British men to fight, basically by saying, "You are men, and I'm more of a man than Nero is." Nero goes around in dresses and sings and all of these things that Boudicca surely couldn't have known. But it's basically Dio digging the knife into Nero.
Yeah.
He gets Boudicca to use feminine pronouns for Nero to actually give him a sex change in her speech. And I think it's really important that he puts that in the mouth of a female barbarian. He's really making the point. This Roman senator saying Nero was more effeminate than a British queen. So he does some quite fanciful stuff. It makes for an even more entertaining read than Tacitus's version, which is something to say.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Senior Lecturer in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University. And you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, please subscribe to it and give it a review in Apple Podcasts. We like reviews, they keep us warm at night. You should also tell your friends about it, because hey, your friends will trust your personal recommendation, won't they? You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Rhiannon on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, and I'm at Nightlight Guy. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, we'll be hearing about another Roman historian. But this time we'll be going further back in history, and we'll be learning about the Augustan historian Livy. So until that episode, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.